ease into today. Yesterday I was all fired up because I did my 9 to 5 again yesterday. And what I've realized is one day into the 9 to 5, get a little excited. 2 days into the 9 to 5, you wake up in the morning and feel a little groggy. I get hit by a bus yesterday. Not as sharp. I really mean this. I know I was joking yesterday's show, and those that you that didn't hear it, that are just listening first time now, that don't really care, so you're like, this is not episodic for me. This is a check-in, depending on the guest. I don't subscribe. I don't review. I'm just kind of a pop-in, pop-by. First of all, stop being that. Just subscribe. Leave 5 stars. Do those things. But yeah, I did Real Kipper and Bourne. Well, actually, just Bourne. I did Bourne yesterday. I did the Bourne show, Bourne and McKee. It was great. It was fun. I gotta say, I really do respect people that do the actual grind. Not the grind like my producer thinks, which is like, hey, can you send me an email with a couple stories? And he's like, fam, there was nothing, fam. There was nothing out there, fam. He wrote, yesterday I asked, so every day I asked my producer to do like, hey, give me a rundown of the stories that you're interested in and, you know, kicker topics and just give me a general idea of the stuff he looked at. His entire work last night was DeRozan. That was it. One line just said DeRozan night. That was his entire night of work. I gave him 24 hours. I booked our guest today and I said, hey, just give me some stuff. He went DeRozan night. I was like, nice. And I just want to say to the 9 to 5ers out there, bless you. I mean this because there are some people that are working in this industry who are legitimately getting paid for that one sentence. Who are getting paid for DeRozan night. So as you're out there grinding away in your 9 to 5, absolutely crushing it, getting home and going, and then your kids are there. You're like, God, I gotta get through this. You gotta make dinner. You gotta get the kids down later. You gotta make sure their homework is finished. You're just out there living very serious lives. I respect the heck out of you. Because I'm just here thinking about stupid stuff to say to sports people. And my producer is here to write DeRozan night for me, which is crucial. Thank you for your service, Armin.
I got you, man.
Yeah, wow. You're just like, someday, I wonder if you should teach at sports journalism schools. What do you, is it you do here? Sometimes in the doc, fam, I write, I got you with DeRozan. It's like, what did DeRozan do? Something. He had a night. DeRozan had a night last night. TBD as to what exactly that entails. But boy, oh boy, are we excited to find out what that was. I got Keegan Madison in a couple minutes. I got Scott Hartnell later on in the show today. I'm excited to speak to both. With Keegan, the pitching, the staff to start the season is starting to take shape. That is a little bit more predictive just in terms of what it takes for ramping up and building up arms and who's looking good and who isn't. And it seems pretty clear that Berríos is the opening day starter at this point. That Bowden Francis is going to have a spot. We don't know if it's the 4 or the 5, though, because of Kevin Gausman's arm. And then we finally get a look at Yariel Rodriguez this weekend because he's going to start pitching. He's going to start ramping up, so we'll see what he has. So some pitching questions with Keegan, who's down there at spring. And then with Scott Hartnell, Leafs play the Flyers tonight. A team where, I don't know if it's because of JR, like one of the most traumatizing moments in my life being the bar down slap shot. But there, maybe it's the Flyers fans, maybe it's just who they represent, what they are, but something about the Flyers and the Leafs makes my blood boil. Like it brings out a more primal side of me where I get angry. I hate the Flyers. I really hate the Flyers. Like I grew up not liking the Red Wings because that was sort of the bandwagon team. And then that became Colorado. They were almost like the more acceptable bandwagon team of my youth. Obviously, I've always hated the Montreal Canadiens. I despise people from this province specifically who cheer for the Montreal Canadiens. I don't care if it was passed down to you from your family. It's abhorrent behavior. It's like being an Ontario native who cheers for the Yankees or the Red Sox. It's the same thing. It's like, what is wrong with you? You think, go there and talk to them, talk to their fans about how they feel about you. You're not a member, all right? You're not part of what they're a part of. You had a chance to be a part of something special here. You didn't do it. Flyers fans are like a different level of, I can't stand it. I don't know what it is. I really don't. Because I kind of like Eagles fans. I kind of like Philly fans in general, just the scumbaggery of it all. The awfulness of them, the battery throwing, the booing Santa Claus, all those things, right? I actually saw a great clip of them. You forget that they also just understand sports, though. When Mario Lemieux came back, it was Flyers fans that got his first night, that gave him the standing ovation, and that cheered him as he came back from his battle from cancer, and were incredible that night, loud for Mario. So they get sports. I just can't stand them, and I hate the Flyers. So, yeah, we're going to talk to Scott later on in the show. How he's feeling about torts and some of the, ref accountability in the game right now. Also game-winning goals because he's got a lot of them. And I was mentioning that the 3-on-3 has kind of changed that. But I just need to quickly say last night's Raptors game was awful. Like truly horrific. Awful, awful stuff. I know we're doing moral victories and no one can criticize this team right now because of the state of the roster. They have a bunch of guys who are hurt. They are playing with, frankly, a bunch of G-leaguers and trying to piece together a couple of rotations that can possibly fit together. This is my question. Are we allowed to criticize anything the Raptors are doing right now? Like, are we allowed to evaluate this on any level? Or is it just, hey, it is what it is and completely let it go? Because I don't understand some of the things, even with this little NBA talent that they have on the roster right now. Some of the stuff Darko is doing, I don't get. I don't understand why Jalen McDaniels is allowed to just run the offense for 5 minutes at a time in a close ball game when he can't dribble the basketball. He has no move around the basket. He's running around like his chicken with his head cut off on defense and really paying no attention to detail, shooting air balls and not getting his teammates involved unless it's a desperation play in which he's already left his feet and trying to basically make a hope pass to a three-point shooter while then also reestablishing and trying to get the ball back. Like, why is that a good thing? If we're talking about player development and younger guys and giving people burn, how is in any way is that good? Because I don't get it. And I know McDaniels, I'm kind of singling him out here, but last night, even with you have a G League player who goes down the floor on a breakaway and throws down a windmill dunk. And that's fun. And you're like, oh, JD, you're such a old man, crusty old man. It's like a bat flip. No, it's not like a bat flip. I love a bat flip. I love players having fun. But you're a G League player. You're getting called up. It's a close ball game. And you're going to windmill dunk? Throw it down. Just throw it down. Make sure that you get the basket. Why is there so much individual play happening when some of these younger guys are getting into the games? Why are they having these just like stretches where it's, hey, guy drives into traffic with a set down, this many turnovers? Again, the talent level is not good, but they are having some real stretches where they don't look well coached and the rotations don't make any sense. And they're taking out what little NBA talent they have and they're sitting them down and they're saying, yeah, we're going to manage your minutes. We're going to manage your workload. Like, why? Why is that happening? Are they actually trying to tank? Is that what's going on here? They want the pick now organizationally. They've fed this to Darko. I just thought that was a frustrating night, and I know not many people are still watching the Raps. I know not many people care. I know that this is not that big of a deal. They're basically trapped between 6 and 7. But if you're looking for some things that you're supposed to care about, I do think being a well-coached team, having some principles, digging in on defense, and being competitive in a second half against a Detroit Pistons team that was historically bad might be a bit of a marker where you want to be okay. You want to have your heads above water. I don't know. Seems like that's reasonable to have. A reasonable expectation to have. Anyway, what's reasonable with the Blue Jays? Keegan Madison, Blue Jays reporter for MLB.com. Did you think that you were coming in on getting mad at the tanking Raptors rant? Is that too much?
I like it. I'm happy that that we're allowed to criticize the Raptors and that it's not all pizza parties and smiles and high fives.
It's infuriating. It's,
what an amazing concept. I fear you're going to be branded as a hater, but
I already am.
That's all right.
Don't
I'm
search
right there
me.
With you.
Don't search me on Raptors Reddit. Actually, it was funny because I was actually on a date recently, and she Googled me, and she was like,
"Never
she,
good."
Well, never she's a big Reddit fan, and Reddit is there's multiple Reddit boards that are like, JD Buggs, who is this guy? He sucks. JD Buggs is a hater. JD Buggs is like, it's every single Reddit thread about me is never, this is a good interview by this guy, or so. It's just, who is this clown? And there's like multiple variations from various fan bases. It's pretty good stuff. And she pulled it up and showed me. I was like, yeah, that's about right. That's about right. So let's try not to get me Reddited in an awful way with the Blue Jay stuff. Your latest column, your latest notes. You outlined that Bowden Francis has now got a grip on the fifth spot of the rotation. I think a lot of us are kind of getting that sense, especially with where Manoah's at physically. But let me start with this. Are we sure it's not the number four spot to start the season, given where Kevin Gausman's at?
It was looking that way maybe a week or two ago. Right now, I'm a bit more confident that Gausman can be ready for that. Even if he is, let's say, the fifth in line, how they line these guys up, those opening series, you can buy Gausman a few more days if you need to.
Yeah.
Normally, he likes to be 75 pitches and 75, his last two starts of spring training. I don't think that's going to happen, obviously, but if he gets up close to that once, then he can have his first MLB start of the season be 80, 85 pitches. That's no problem. Your bullpen is as fresh as it's going to be. I think he'll be ready at this point. It is still on a bit of a line. You never want to be playing catch-up. But thankfully, the Blue Jays' depth is in a bit better a place. The last 2 years, I have not liked it at all, and I think the Blue Jays were very fortunate. They did not need to reach too deep into it. They're in a much better place right now, and that starts with Francis. I like Bowden Francis a lot, and a lot of people here do, too. He's looked really good.
So I do want to get to Bowden in a second, but if it was the case where they decided to play it really cautious with Gausman, right? They went, you know what? We don't want to screw around. This is our staff ace. We've already got the injury to Manoah. Who is now the fifth guy? Or sorry, who's now the sixth guy? Because I don't even have Manoah in that conversation until he can actually throw baseballs consistently.
I think it would go in the direction of a Mitch White, and it might look a bit like what they did last year when Manoah first went down. You remember their immediate plan B was Bowden Francis and Trevor Richards, kind of piggybacking one another. It wasn't ideal, but you were able to get through a couple. And if Gausman just needs one or two starts to build up, that's totally fine to do a couple of times. Now, if you needed a starter more long-term, that's when you start thinking about how quickly you can build up Yariel Rodriguez, Ricky Tiedemann, all the talent on the planet. Maybe a bit early for him. I think he still starts in AAA unless something goes completely disastrous down here. But next in line, I'd say a bit of a Mitch White, Trevor Richards taped together with a paint job on it.
Okay, that's good. That's great. I was hoping that you were going to say that something else emerged down there where you were like, you know what, they might take a look at this and it's kind of interesting. You know, sell me on hope rather than just the reality of that bleakness.
That's tough this spring. Yeah. I'm not selling many of those.
Okay, I was going to say, man, this is one of the things I'm going to get into because Bowden Francis seems to me, you tell me if I'm wrong because I'm not there, but I consume all the content. You know, I'm reading your stuff. I'm following Ben. You know, I'm sending out the odd text to people. And Francis seems like he's getting a lot of buzz, that the pitch mix looks good, that the velo is up. Your piece did a good job of outlining that, hey, he's trying to build up that arm right now, but it shouldn't be an issue, that the Jays might have a find here. But the rest of spring, it's like, what's the secondary storyline in terms of real positivity that's blooming to you? Because I see, like, Ernie Clement is making a case for himself. I'm like, that's great, but this can't be the Ernie Clement year. And I know it's spring or whatever, but, yeah, what's been the storyline outside of Bowden Francis? Like, what are we looking at where you're going, oh, yeah, you know what, a lot of people down here, I'm having a lot of conversations about X.
I tell you what, JD, I'm on day, 35 of camp? I'm asking myself that question.
You know the day of camp you're actually at? Are you scrawling it on the wall like a prisoner? Like, are you?
It's getting dark. There's a such thing as too much Florida, and you start to... And as our friends come in and out, you know, I'll have Shy here with me for a couple of weeks, and Ben, I believe I have Sportsnet's Dave Singh coming down next on the TV side of the same. So I'm turning into the crazy guy that's stuck here and hoping people bring me, you know, trinkets from the outside world. But when you look around camp, there's really not that thing that's knocking you over, frankly. Yeah. Ernie Clement is a good one. I think he's put himself in a spot to make this roster. Uh-huh. But we're talking about the 26th spot on the roster. That's not going to excite anybody. This team needs to impact its ceiling, not the floor. The floor is fine. You need a higher ceiling if you're this team. Joey Votto's a fantastic story. I'm fascinated by how this is all happening. But again, we're talking about the floor, not the ceiling. So if you are looking at that ceiling, and I've said the same, I think, the last few springs, but right now, Bo Bichette looks as good as I have ever seen him. He is in ridiculous shape, better than I have ever seen, and it's not close. I think he is a player who has another level to his game there, but you're talking about something that we already have seen. You know, he is going to be the guy that is driving this. And looking around the rest of camp, you're looking for those internal improvements. You're looking for Vladdy. You're looking for Kirk. But it kind of captures where this team is at, that you need to see it happen. Regular season, and it's kind of at the point where the spring training hype has almost lost the edge, frankly, because you want it to happen in the season.
Yeah, it's true. I think that a lot of the hype around the team is just it's gone now. Like, there's not it's very much just call us when you're doing it. Don't
it
tell
needs
us.
To be earned back.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
I've said this a few times, that even if this team wins 100 games this year, we are sitting here on October 2nd saying prove it.
Yeah. Actually, damn, that's true. I think that they've got a lot to lose with, like, say, a slow start or having a mediocre season or a season that feels like last year where the pitching is good but the offense is very mediocre and it feels like there's a je ne sais quoi with the team that isn't happening. They're not resonating. It does feel as though they need Vladdy and Bo both to be studs, like exciting players that you really want to go see down at the ballpark. But you're right in terms of, hey, was this season a success or not? They're kind of entering Maple Leafs territory of, you got to get it done in the playoffs and we're not really going to go too crazy over anything that you do in the regular season. But yeah, that's why you sign more impactful free agents sometimes than Justin Turner to try and buy some of those narratives early on. But hey, it is what it is. But okay, let's dig in on Bowden Francis a little bit though, because if we're talking about ceiling, that's awesome with Bo Bichette. But yeah, he's always been that guy to me where I'm like, yeah, this guy's going to drive the team now. He is the face of the franchise now. He is that guy. That's great to hear. That does excite me knowing that he is in that incredible shape. And I've always looked at him that way anyway, though, is that he's never going to leave a stone unturned when it comes into trying to get better. But with Bowden Francis, I view him as a ceiling guy in this sense of, one, you need pitching depth, but two, like going into spring training, I wasn't sure it was going to be a guarantee that Manoa ended up with that fifth starter spot, that it was going to have to be earned. And the fact that you might actually have somebody here who's not just a fifth starter in the sense of, oh, you're throwing him out there, but who actually, he seems to be someone who could be good. Not ace, not, this isn't a top tier prospect, right? But someone who actually could conceivably end up looking like a plus five starter. Is that the way it feels to you?
It does. This is not a depth guy who's trying to slop his way through five innings.
Right.
There's some more upside with his actual stuff and with his build. I mean, Francis was great as a reliever last year, but he is a starter. I'm a big guy. He's bigger than me. And if that's where you are built to be a starter. He is 6'5", strong, well-built guy. And I think that'll let him hold his stuff over a start, which is the real key for him. Still throwing 94, 95 in the fifth inning, not just the first. That'll come. But Bowden is not just talented, but I think one of the most interesting players in this camp, in this league, when it comes to his mental game. You know, when I talk to him after starts, he is taking a breath. He's taking his thoughts. He's talking about manifesting what's happening on the field. He's talking about his breath work. He's talking about envisioning what's going on out there. He is extremely thoughtful and mindful about how he goes through all of this. And he's also talked about how it used to work when he wasn't that. It blew up on him in the minor leagues. And this is why some guys develop a bit later. You don't need to be a superstar at 22. You don't need to be Ricky Tiedemann getting written about every day as a number one. It happens a little later for some guys. In Toronto, we've seen that more with hitters, but it can happen with pitchers too. And I really think that Bowden is a lock in a rotation on a lot of teams in this league. He's looked really impressive. And what impresses me most is that other starters are praising him. They don't do that just kind of willy-nilly, and it's not empty. You know, when you're getting praise from other guys in that rotation, it really means something, and he's gotten a ton of that.
So there is a fallout to this, though, right? Which is, okay, if he's an above-average fifth starter and he's pitching well, what does Manoa have to do to jump him? Because at this point, it's clear he's going to start the season in Buffalo and that he's going to have to earn the Jays' trust, but like, can he steal that job from Bowden Francis? Like, what's your read on how the next steps go for Alec?
With all of my optimism here at once, by that point, something else will have gone wrong. But
you can't play that. You can't play that card because that's obvious.
Does.
No, but yes, it does.
If he's coming back, he'll have to win the job.
Yeah.
He'll have to actually earn it. That's the point this is at. He will not be walking back into something. And this does feel like a situation where it enters the year, turns into a rehab stint eventually, which is just kind of a rebranded start in the minor leagues. That can work well for both sides, I think, frankly. But it's not going to be something, I don't think, that he is just walking back into. You can't just have a 6 ERA over a few starts and come back and take the job. After last season, that doesn't happen anymore. And this team, especially, if all five guys are rolling, you let it go. And I think Alec will need to earn that back when the time comes. He has done some work to move in that direction, both with his body and his relationship with the team and how this is all going, but I think it still has to be something he grabs and takes.
Yeah. So this is what I find most fascinating right now. It's like the Manoah story was always going to be the biggest one of spring, right? Because normally jobs aren't earned there. We can tend to get a little carried away with some of these stories. Most years, I actually think this season has been very reasonable because of the lack of hype element that we discussed earlier, right? Mm-hmm. Which is we're not blowing stuff out of proportion. There aren't too many things where like people aren't going to lose their minds over Vogelbach versus 40-year-old Joey Votto, right? Just it ain't going to happen. And Ernie Clement, it's a nice story, and we'll see what ends up happening here. But no one's coming down to the ballpark to see Ernie, so no one's really spending too much time on it. But with Manoah, the idea was, hey, this dude spent every single day of the offseason posting on his Instagram that he was working out, that he was getting in better shape. And every single insider I talked to and every person that I tried to feel on Manoah was, yeah, you know, maybe they could, but the market's not really there. And it doesn't feel as though they're being overly aggressive in terms of trying to move him. They want to bring him back. They want to try to recuperate the value. Then it was he's entering spring with a fairly healthy lead as the fifth starter in terms of the leash he's going to have. They want to build the confidence back up. He gets the injury, and now he's going to start. And, you know, in Buffalo, that's not a big deal. You're right. The optics of this early are fine. What I find most curious is what happens if he's down there kind of dealing, looking good, looking like the old Alec Manoah, but Bowden Francis is pitching well, and these guys stay healthy, and he's maintaining an ERA that's around 4. That, like, what is the decision that the Blue Jays make if that's the call? Will they leave Manoah down there? Will they try to jump him up immediately and push Bowden Francis down? Like, I don't think that's really been – I don't know if we have the answer to that.
No, we don't yet. It's probably, you know, the unlikeliest way this all goes,
sure,
with everything going right at the same time. But if it does, and every once in a while it's going to, if it does, you've got a very good problem. I don't think it points to a trade or anything like that. That's easy to have kind of my old video game brain where you have six guys, you trade one and get a great second baseman or something. That's not how it works. But I think that would be a lovely problem for this team to have, and maybe by midseason there are ways you can work in an extra starter. These rotation guys, the veterans especially, you look at Bassett, Kikuchi, Gosman, they're coming off a ton of innings last year, and sustaining that is going to be tough. That's something Chris Bassett talked about early in camp, which I respected. He wasn't looking at this foolishly. He was saying, look, I live in reality. It might not repeat itself that all of those innings come from all of us again. It'll need some depth there. So if Manoah makes that an uncomfortable conversation, that's a great thing for the organization. And especially as you are approaching a deadline, if you have a surplus, sure, that's a good thing to have, especially if you're looking to improve an offense. And by that point as well, I mean, if we're talking May, June, Ricky Tiedemann could be kicking the door down, like absolutely booting the door in where you have to get him on the roster. At a certain point, you just need your 13 best pitchers. That could take a lot of weird shapes. I know the bulk guy role is a little more popular now. It's not the demotion it used to be, but Tiedemann could be just as much involved in this. Same with Yariel Rodriguez.
Yeah.
This could get crowded in a very good way, but very crowded.
Yeah, I think where you want to be is that you can be very patient with Tiedemann, and that if he forces his way into major league innings, that you're ready to find a spot for him eventually. But yeah, in regards to the flipping one of those pitchers, if both of them are going well, you're definitely not doing that because the injuries and the fact that you just outlined Mitch White is the guy behind them until Ricky Tiedemann is ready to assume that role. yeah, you're not messing around with that whatsoever. Plus, like, yeah, I don't know how a deal like that gets done during this season, especially if the Blue Jays are competitive. It makes, I guess, a little bit more sense if they're out of it come deadline time, what how they would evaluate their starting staff or what they would do with those guys. But, yeah, I don't think anybody's thinking that way just yet. You just hope that Alek Manoah, if he is pitching well, and if this scenario does happen, which you're right, is unlikely, that he's going to end up being okay with it. And that, yeah, it doesn't become a story where people are going, man, Manoah's getting annoyed that he's still down there. He wants to pitch in the majors, and he feels like he's earned a spot. Okay, so, yeah, you mentioned Yariel Rodriguez. He's pitching Sunday. I think you said it's conceivably enough time for him to make the team. But, yeah, how does he fit into all this? And weirdly enough, you just said Mitch White is their kind of sneaky seven starter. Feels like he's also the guy that's behind Yariel Rodriguez in the bulk role. Does he have options? Like, what happens there? How does he go from being kind of that more important role to potentially not on the team? Because when I'm looking at this, it kind of feels like he's a pivot guy.
Yeah, he is right on that line right now. And if I was lining up the bullpen, White is kind of that easy eighth guy in the bullpen who gives you bulk innings, but maybe the first one out, depending on how everything else is going. And Rodriguez, I think, just needs a bit more time. You know, he'll be up to about two innings on Sunday. Maybe gets to three in his next one this spring, but Schneider said they'd like to get him up near five. So that implies there's more stretching out to do. And from the beginning, I thought the AAA was an option, not as a demotion, but just as part of this plan. Mm-hmm. Then he missed that week or so with back spasms. I think that made it more likely at this point. Mm-hmm. And even if it just kicks it a couple of weeks into the season, just to get him comfortable, get him back into a groove. I mean, routines is the buzzword of spring. Every spring has a buzzword that I grow to hate. But what it means is that just getting a guy normal. You know, Yariel has not pitched on a regular schedule in over a year. So get him normal, pitching every 4 or 5 days, built up, doing his thing over and over, then bring him up. I think that makes a lot of sense. Now, Yariel could be a starter. He could be pitching two innings. You can max him out over one inning like he did overseas. There's a lot of ways this can look, but you're seeing, again, just like the rotation we're talking about, JD, and this kind of bulk role, bullpen role, there's a lot of pitchers here. It's a good thing on the pitching side. That's why people are so confident that this pitching staff will be good again and that you need upside from the offense, because even if one or two guys falter and have a bad year, which is going to happen in the bullpen, you've got a few more options there, and I like Rodriguez a lot. That's a signing that at least had upside to it. I think that's my favorite deal of the offseason, because you can at least see it working out better than expected.
Yeah. Do you out of all those roles, though, that the Blue Jays probably hope for him, it is a upper bulk arm, though, right? Like someone who does come in and pitches two innings for them, but pitches them well?
Yeah, I see that this year, a bulk role this year, kind of hybrid-y, stretching him out to be a starter next year, when you could lose a Kikuchi or have a bullpen, or sorry, a rotation roll open. So stretching him out through this year, starter next year.
Okay. All right. So let's do a little bullpen talk then, because it looks deep. I know everybody's joking about Mesa right now and the MLB, the show rating and all that different stuff. But my biggest thing is, how does Romano look? Because last year it was a little shaky. And it was basically, you know, they lost Hicks in free agency, and I don't think anybody talked about it. I don't know how much, that was like the least amount of oxygen that was spent on a kind of high-profile guy that they brought in here, and everyone said, well, you know, they might bring him back. And then I don't really remember one serious conversation about the Blue Jays trying to bring him back. He departs. You look at the bullpen, it's all familiar characters, and, you know, they'll have a full season, I guess, where they say they're going to have Chad Green. But ultimately, a lot of this rests on, do you have one of the best closers in Major League Baseball again? Or do you have the guy that, you know, we saw flashes from last year that got a little bit shaky? What's the word on Romano?
Yeah, because not everybody can close. You need your closer to be your closer. And Romano, admittedly, over the years, has enjoyed putting two guys on, making it real interesting, and then getting the last guy. He's very good at adding some drama and then dominating in the biggest at-bat of the game. So. Yeah. He has, when you look at the broader numbers over the last few years, been one of the more consistent relievers in baseball, which doesn't maybe feel like it, you know, if you're watching the games each night, because there are the close calls. But Romano has this ability to make the last pitch when it matters. And I know this from having a lot of stories that I'm getting nervous about on the final out I'm going to have to burn down and write again, and then Romano saves it. I still think he is one of the truly top-end closers in this game. Any reliever can have an absolute terrible year at any time. We see how this works, but I think Romano's proven himself with that consistency, with the ability to kind of pull it back onto the road right before it goes into the ditch. If you do that a few times, maybe it's a coincidence. If you do it 100 times, I start to believe in it. And Romano's a guy who I think has earned the right to ramp up a little bit at his own pace. You know, in camp, he's not going to be out here pacing around and dripping sweat and throwing 98 like he is in the season. Mm-hmm. But I think we'll see him a little bit more frequently these last 10 days or so as he gets ready for the season. And for him, you know, health is a big thing as well. He's got to make sure he's not dealing with anything. Some minor issues last year, he was working around. But I think when you see it over and over, the way that he kind of tap dances out of this danger that sometimes he creates himself, sure, but he always gets out of it. And I think the consistency has been there at a position where guys just aren't all that consistent.
Yeah, so last year was a little different, though, because in the second half of the season, he wasn't the same guy. And, like, the OPS against him in September, October ballooned to, like, 746 against, which is, like, yeah, you know, like, August is 388, 649. So you're, I guess, reading between the lines on that, you're more a believer of a guy that does kind of dance between the raindrops at times. This maybe is just more of a, hey, now they started to go against him. Because it felt a little bit more like that in the moment where he was like, maybe working back from an injury or whatever. But, yeah, that's just the byproduct more so of a guy that, yeah, pitches that way, where he has to pitch himself out of trouble in the ninth inning.
Yeah, I believe in the results at this point. If I'd been asked this maybe 2-3 years ago, coming off his first good year, mm-hmm. I would have leaned a bit more to maybe projecting some regression or a little bit of luck swinging to the left or the right. But at this point, he's done it. Mm-hmm. And I think a full, healthy season will be big for him. And I think Jordan's gotten a lot smarter, like most relievers do as they age, mm-hmm. with managing his workload and the strain on his body, understanding that maybe you can take that off day in between appearances. This is something we talk more about with starters, but I think Jordan and some of the relievers are starting to understand this better, of managing yourself, knowing when you're on a hot streak and you don't need to keep driving and driving yourself between these outings, saving some bullets for late in the year, because Romano has also had a pretty big workload for a reliever and has not had much downtime throughout that. So managing that's going to be important, because it's not just about getting that save in Baltimore on a Tuesday in April. It's mm-hmm. about late October when relievers really are running out of gas.
Yeah. And again, the Blue Jays bullpen is deep, right? Like, you look at the names and it's the same cast of characters essentially that you saw last year, right? Like, they're deep. But has there been, you always want it is a bullpen, right? You mentioned it, fluctuate, can end up with a guy who was amazing the year before and then kind of garbage the year after, or a guy who was kind of written off and then he ends up being a star. But yeah, you've been there on the island for over a month. You know, you're scratching the days into the wall when you wake up every morning, when you go to bed each night. It's when you see the sunrise. That's how it's got to be. When you see the sunrise, you're scratching one into the wall. But has there been one of these guys in the bullpen, and maybe someone who's not going to make the team, that when you're talking to people around the Blue Jays, they're saying, you know, we're fairly optimistic about this. We're really like what we're seeing from this person.
You're starting to see some prospect guys come up that are actual relievers, not just failed starters who are turning into hybrids, but guys who come up as relievers, which I like. Connor Cook is one. Connor Cook has gotten a lot of attention here in camp. He's a very hard-throwing right-hander. There's some attention around him. You're looking at the fringe guys who are off this roster, which I think could include a Nate Pearson down in AAA.
You're not doing that again.
Some of these upside arms. I know we have that conversation annually. Mm-hmm. But you're going to have guys like Pearson pop off this roster who are better than a lot of organizations can do bringing a guy up, mm-hmm. at least in May or June. Looking around the roster, I think Jimmy Garcia is going to bounce back this year, mm-hmm. frankly. I know that's not an exciting or a sexy name, but Jimmy is a guy that always comes into camp real hot, real early. Like, he's the guy throwing 97 in the middle of February, and he has looked great this year. I think a lot of his numbers are going to bounce back naturally. And that's important as that seventh kind of eighth inning guy. And then you're going to get a full season of Chad Green, which is probably the one that gets brought up to me most unprompted, is a full season of Chad Green, which is what this team had in mind back when they signed him. I think that's a real benefit to this group. And a guy that if you do lose Romano, knock on wood for them, but if you do, He's a guy that can step in to that ninth inning and has pitched in a lot of those big moments.
Yeah, no, I'm a big Chad Green guy. What I will say is, and this is so rude and so unfair, but the very first spring game where Pearson came in, and what was it, back-to-back bombs?
It all happened real quick, real
ugly. Yeah, it was like boom, boom, and I just said, yeah, I'm not doing this. I refuse to play the game of, well, you know, the upside is there, and he's accepted being a relief pitcher. Now, I ain't doing any of it. I just, if it happens, great. But he is the ultimate. I'm not spending 1 minute on what it could be if all the dominoes fall. It's like I've been tricked too many times. I've already fallen for that too many times. And we went way too far after the Tampa outing in the playoffs when he first came. And we were like, oh, my God, he's going to be the best pitcher in Major League Baseball. But the guy that you mentioned there that I am a little interested in is Pop, because he did have a moment where you went, ooh, like this guy looks like he could be very, you know, really serious. And then that completely kind of dissipated. And I was curious about his spring and whether or not he was going to make the roster, but it looks like he's on the outside looking in still as well.
Yeah, it looks like he is. Yeah. He'd be in that number 9, number 10 conversation, which, again, is not bad. That's a good place to be if you need another reliever on April 20th, May 30th, whenever it is. That's a good place to be. Pop last year really got it working with that slider off of the sinker, and it looked great for a while. It was really hot. And, frankly, that's what you need once or twice a year. You need a guy unexpectedly to get hot for 2 months. You need to know when to roll him out at the right time and when to cash out at the right time. That's how you build a good bullpen outside of your core 5, 6, 7 guys. And Pop will be there. He's got another shot to have another one of those runs. It'll start on the outside. It'll start in Buffalo, I think, with Pearson, Cook, some of these other guys in around him. But quantity is a good approach. You know, they don't all need to be a top prospect. If you have 4 or 5 relievers on the fringes, you just need one of them to pop. And I like a quantity approach to the bullpen. It's so unpredictable. So if one of them can really catch fire, you win.
So last thing. You mentioned in your when you projected the roster, you do have Ernie Clement there in that final spot. How do the Blue Jays make that work then? Like, what? How does this operate with Espinal? Do you think that, like, how does the bench look? Let's put it that way. If he's a part of it, how does the bench work, and how does the infield end up working coming into the season?
I do like Clement at this point. I think he's at a fantastic camp. He's out of options, which will help. So you'll have one of the backup catchers, whichever one is not playing that day on the bench. You'll have Vogelbach on the bench. You'll have Clement on the bench. Then out of that crowded group, it's a Biggio, it's a Schneider, somebody else will be on the bench that day. It's a bench that I like a little bit more than last year. You can play the matchups with a guy who crushes righties in Vogelbach. Clement is kind of like Alejandro Kirk in a weird way, a guy who I would really like as a pinch hitter. If you just need a ball in play, he makes ridiculous contact. Every time he swings, he hits the ball. All contact, all the time. So I like that matchup, and I like Clement on this roster. A bit awkward to have Espinal on the outside. He has the relationships. He has the history with the team, but it eventually does need to change, I think, at this point. And having Espinal still with the organization would be still a very good thing, obviously, and he's beloved in that clubhouse. But right now, Clement is making this a more of a decision than I thought it would be, frankly, coming into camp. And he's a guy who does not get enough credit for how athletic he is. He's a great natural athlete, and I think can play multiple positions and come in after a week on the bench and make a ton of contact. He's a big leaguer. He is a big leaguer this season. I think it happens in Toronto, but if it happens somewhere else, he's in the big leagues.
Yeah, but the implication here, though, is that it's becoming more likely Espinal ends up not being a part of this organization at all, and the Jays recoup absolutely nothing for him. They weren't going to get anything much at all in the first place. I think that they probably explored that during the offseason, but is that the way you see it going?
Yeah, I don't project Espinal on this roster right now. It's certainly not 100% lean. It's more of a leaning to one side of Clement, we can put it. And it's still totally conceivable to see Espinal on this roster. But where it is right now, I do lean to Clement. And I know there's been a lot of folks bring up over the spring, how about you take two of them, trade them somewhere else, and get something. You're not going to get something that improves your roster.
Yeah.
You're going to get a prospect that maybe we see a flash of in 4 years. You're not going to package two depth infielders together to get a star third baseman. It's not MLB The Show 2012 or something. So It's if the trade market did work like that, this would be great. But kind of like the pitching side, like the Blue Jays' middle infield depth picture, it's just so crowded.
Yep.
Right now, I do like Clement, but kind of like we talked about those relievers, you just hope that one really pops. You hope that one gets off to a great start and does something that raises the ceiling of this roster. And that's what it comes back to for me, JD, is just what's your thing? How are you going to raise the ceiling? Clement, elite contact. Espinal, maybe he can hit some lefties while he plays defense, but if you're just depth for the sake of depth, that doesn't do much. You got to have a thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. By the way, no one's going to hold you to your which middle infield depth guy they end up with. So just to lean, I'm like, we're talking about our hateful Reddit threads. I don't think you're going to get a hateful Reddit. You know, Keegan Mathison thought it was going to be Ernie Clement. Then it ends up being an all season thing. Okay. We'll let you go, but you know, you are on the island. You are there stuck in baseball purgatory. Just day after day after day of these conversations. Is there anything you need to get off your chest? Like you're speaking to another human being that's back in the real world. Is there anything you need right now?
You know what? I see the light. I am five days away from getting back to Canada for a quick wedding.
Oh,
I think I've done hotel
like
laundry for the last time.
You're a prisoner. You get to leave the prison for a wedding or a funeral, and then you got to go right back.
Yeah, in Vancouver, too. It's very close to Florida, so it's all lining up for me, baby. But I think I've done hotel laundry for the last time, so I'm cruising out. I've kicked it into neutral, and I'm just hoping a story comes and smacks me in the face today.
God, that's so good. You're Johnny Sachs. You're leaving for your daughter's wedding, and then they're going to drag you off in handcuffs right at the end of it as they're all yelling at the officers bringing you back down to spring. Hey, Keegan, it's great to chat with you, buddy. Thanks so much for making time.
You got him, man. Take care.
Cheers, pal. There he goes. Keegan Mathison. That reminds me. I obviously will dig the odd Sopranos reference. I actually had a person, I can't remember if it was a tweet or a DM or what it was. Reach out anytime, at JD Bunkus, Twitter and Instagram. Might have been a review, actually, on the podcast page, where someone tried to pace me with, I'm finally watching Sopranos and you're spoiling stuff for me. And I went, are you out of your mind? Are you out of your damn mind that you think that the world should not speak about a show that it began in 99. Okay. 1999 is when the Sopranos started. That is wild behavior. I'm sorry. I'm speaking that one. I saw that. I don't think I replied. I don't know. Can't remember where it was. Every once in a while, you get a message from somebody that really breaks through. It breaks through just the either a nice compliment someone gets or an engagement on a topic, which is nice, or a thought on something. But every once in a while, you get that special person that, you know, cracks the monotony of the tweets and the DMs. And don't spoil Sopranos for me, a show with the most famous ending ever to any TV series, and that wrapped up in 2007, is wild, wild behavior. I will be making as many Sopranos references as I want, and I will be making as many as I can, which is that one with Keegan, him leaving to go to a wedding. John Sacramone leaving for his daughter, getting out of jail for his daughter's wedding. This is what happens. He gets out of jail for his daughter's wedding, and as he's doing it and as he's trying to kind of conduct some business, the cops pull him away in cuffs in front of his daughter, and it spoils the end of the wedding, just like I spoiled that episode for you, you weirdo. Anyways, thanks for listening. Thanks for subscribing if you did leave it there. But yeah, leave a 5-star review. Don't be bitter about that weird Sopranos guy. Anyway, let's take a quick break. Let's come back. I already was on Kipper and Bourne yesterday, and we did enough on the McMahon extension. We put it up in the Leafs Talk feed, so if you want that, subscribe and review there as well. But I've been thinking a little bit more about the Marner stuff. I think it is an important reminder with the McMahon contract, the percentage. And there's a record, a non-Leafs record, but there's a record that I actually care about and I'm interested in looking out for, weirdly. That's next.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
So first of all, actually, congratulations, Bobby McMahon. Guy stuck with it. hard to believe, probably was hard for him to believe when he was grinding away with the Newfoundland Growlers just a couple of years ago, that he thought he was going to be playing his way into a couple million dollars. So good for him, truly. I love stories like that. Who doesn't like stories like that? I'd actually like to get him on. Leafs don't ever like giving up players for interviews anymore, and I don't know what's up with that, but you'd think McMahon would be one of the dudes that they would kind of want to push. Maybe he's on Kipper Born later. I don't know. What, is he on Kipper Born? We know? No? They're not doing that? And we should be trying to do that. So great story. Don't know too much about the guy. I haven't heard him speak too often. I also haven't had other people that are around the team tell me too much. But, yeah, it's, again, an awesome story. So good for him for getting the contract. I said I think that he had probably a little bit more to gain on this deal had he gone into the postseason and actually tried to up his value with a strong playoff performance. But this is fine for all parties involved, and it's a couple million bucks. It's awesome. And it's going to be 1.6% of the salary cap next season. Pretty sure he'll be able to make good on that kind of value, right? I think that we can all agree it's good signing for the Leafs, good depth, good size. Guy can forecheck. Guy plays with energy. He earned the deal. Good for him. It's a small sample. Nothing much else to it. But, yeah, I like how those kind of effort players who are going to be willing to go into the corners, who are going to be willing to stand in front of the net, who are going to hustle and try to get loose pucks, that to me feels like more of the way to build the bottom six out, in my opinion, than some of the other guys that they've tried in the past with the bottom six, like the Nick Pétains or the Pierre Engvalls, the softer guys who will possess the puck a little bit more, that look better when they actually have the puck on their stick. Although McMahon's looked better at that too recently, especially off the rush. But yeah, give me the hard-nosed guys that have the more playoff style than the finesse players that have faded come postseason time, or who I think are a little bit more difficult to slot into your roster, like we talked about with Nick Robertson yesterday with Ailish Forfar. The other thing with Leafs, though, is the Mitch Marner stuff is a little spooky, I got to say. It's quiet on the knee, and I don't like when teams get quiet on the injury, because even the people who know him and are, you know, have stuff from the camp, they're not revealing stuff, and I wonder why that is. And the team, I will say this. Yesterday on Kipper and Bourne, they played a clip of Sheldon Keefe talking about the knee injury. To me, it was more of a he's not skating. Read into that what you will. We were joking about it. That's actually, to me, more he's just not playing in the Flyers game, and we'll get an update at some point moving forward. Not, hey, read into that what you will. He's out for a really long time. But either way, you kind of want to give them the just be there for playoffs line. Just get right for playoffs line. You want to make sure that this isn't something spooky with the knee. That's all. Anyway, I want to pay off the tease. There's a sports record that I actually care about right now, and it's this Daniel Gafford thing. Probably none of you have even heard about it, because it's kind of a dumb record. I hadn't heard about it. But, okay, Daniel Gafford, a guy who I've always sort of liked. I've seen him play live courtside, essentially, when he was with the Washington Wizards, and I thought, this guy can actually play. Just kind of a rim-running center, someone that doesn't do too much for you, blocks a couple of shots. You probably aren't even aware of who this guy is. But, yeah, he's like a, I think he was probably a second-round pick. I think he was a second-round pick out of Arkansas, right? Yeah, that's where he went. Okay, so this guy, he right now has made 33 consecutive field goals. Who would have thought? 33 straight. Again, makes sense for a player whose primary function is catching lobs and finishing them at the basket. Now, playing with Luka Doncic, a guy who doesn't, he's probably not going to get too many opportunities, and when he does get them, Daniel Gafford's not going to be shooting, you know, fadeaways. It's not away from the basket. But why this is interesting is because Wilt Chamberlain holds the record for consecutive field goals made in the NBA at 35. It's kind of a cool record. Most field goals made in a row. The problem is there's no way this guy is not aware of it. And there's absolutely no way that he's going to take any shots. The next three shots he takes, he will not do anything other than wide open dunks. I'm talking no shot at any, 0% chance this guy takes a shot. Even if he's wide open late in the clock, gets the ball, he'll just turn it over. He's going to swallow it. I think he's going to break this record, but I'm fairly interested in seeing it. Like I'm telling you, I will be tuning in to the next Mavericks game because I'm going to watch.
They asked him about it last night. He said, I'm not going to jinx myself.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. No, he
definitely
cares.
Of course he plays OKC next game, so.
No, of course he knows. Of course he knows. Because this would be...
Do you want to see it, though? Like, obviously, Gafford...
No, I'm rooting against it. I always root for the greats. Yeah, I always root for the greats with the records. I always do. That's just a... I'm sorry. I'm a bad person. I root for the greats. I root for the... Wilt Chamberlain is an all-time great player. Him having the field goals made record makes it mean something to me. The idea that Daniel Gafford could hold the consecutive field goals made record makes it almost meaningless to me. So, no, there's stakes. I'm a protector of basketball history. I love basketball history. I don't want Daniel Gafford to hold this record. I hope he misses. I hope he chokes. I hope he gets stuffed.
Chet might block him, yeah.
I hope he gets stuffed by Chet right at the rim. I wonder if they would stop the game against OKC. Because OKC, if you remember, LeBron's got the goals. It's got the... The scoring record against Oklahoma City, and they stopped the game, obviously, and LeBron ran around, and he said he didn't care about it because all he cares about is rings. So you knew that wasn't true. The second he said it, he went, well, he's going to celebrate this like a championship. He passed Kareem, and they paused the game against Oklahoma City. And then Oklahoma City, by the way, went on and won the game because the Lakers are losers. But... I wonder if they'll pause the game for Gafford. I wonder if they'll do that. He gets his third dunk of the game, and the Oklahoma City, because it's in Oklahoma City, or is it in Dallas?
I got to check one sec.
That's a big differentiator. If it's in Dallas, I hope that...
It's in Oklahoma.
Bummer. If it was in Dallas and I was Mark Cuban, I'd be petty about it. And I'd, you know, Mark Cuban will always have a special place in my heart. He's the guy that voted against, actually, Oklahoma City going to Oklahoma City. He voted for them to stay in Seattle, didn't like the move. That was when Mark Cuban was invested in the NBA before he was, you know, trying to sneakily leave out the back door, which God knows what that implication means. But either way, Daniel Gafford, I hope you miss. Quick break. Let's come back. Let's talk to Scott Hartnell. All right, Scott Hartnell in a couple minutes. First, I have breaking news. The Pittsburgh Penguins announced today that a shipment carrying the Yager bobbleheads for tonight's game has been stolen en route to Pittsburgh. As a result, the bobbleheads will not be distributed at tonight's game, but will be distributed at a later date. Now, don't fret. All fans in attendance will receive a voucher that includes a one-time scannable barcode. All fans in attendance, by the way. Not just first ones in or whatever. All fans, every single fan, all of them in, will get a bobblehead voucher. Location and dates for pickup will be shared when the items are safely located or new bobbleheads are produced and available. I'll tell you this. I think grown men who like to get bobbleheads are weirdos. Sorry. Ennis has many, by the way. Many. Many, many, many bobbleheads. When I go to Blue Jays games and it's bobblehead giveaway day, I always show up late. I don't want to be there on time. I want to get there with just enough space to buffer me out of bobblehead guy zone. It's my least favorite days at the ballpark is that. I don't mind a giveaway. I love a good giveaway. Who doesn't like a giveaway? Who doesn't like being at the ballpark and grabbing a giveaway? But if you get a bobblehead and you give them, you got them for your kids, that's great. The little trinkets, awesome. I know that there's like bobblehead museums and some of these things end up with value, whatever. I hate seeing after bobblehead night, the guys on the street trying to sell them. People, grown men that got there early trying to yell out and offer them up at a price. Awful. And you see it all the time, the bobblehead guys who are out there trying to hawk them. And then there are the weird other dudes that are there, and you can see them with, like, multiple somehow. And I'm like, how the hell did this happen? So, wait, were you buying these off people in the stadium? Like, what's happening here? You always see, like, the odd person that grabs the extra bobblehead that's walking around. That's throwing the bobblehead away. I actually, little quick story, almost got in a little bit of a conflict last year with my brother in town because I yelled. There was one guy, he was actually, I think he buys the Phillies. Maybe not. Maybe I'm just thinking I got Flyers on the brain. But we couldn't have been that. There was some guy walking through. He had a bobblehead, and he wouldn't give it to a little girl. And he was yelling, $100, $100. And she walked up to him and was like, can I have the bobblehead? And he was like, no. And then I said something. And then it devolved into name-calling and separations. Separations ended up happening. Awkward moment. Bobblehead guys, weirdos. Sorry, true. But all this being said, strong but coming here. If you told me I could get one of the stolen Jager bobbleheads, I would. I've never wanted a bobblehead more. I've never wanted any type of giveaway, anything more. I don't want the voucher. I don't want the voucher. I don't want the new bobblehead. The reproduced bobblehead. Actually, I kind of wouldn't mind the reproduced bobblehead. It would be like a... You can put that somewhere. So I have room for that in my apartment. Did a little bit of a story. This Jager bobblehead was produced because a shipment was stolen. I have a little bit of time for that bobblehead as well. But to get one of the stolen bobbleheads, if you could prove it was stolen and I was buying those stolen goods and I didn't have to return them, I'm kind of into that. Give me a stolen Jager bobblehead. But outside of that, bobbleheads are kind of for losers. I'm kind of hoping our next guest is a huge bobblehead guy. And he's like, man, I have like a million. I always, every night we'd have a bobblehead night when I was playing. I always made sure to make sure that an equipment manager procured me one so that I could have it. It's Scott Hartnell, former NHL forward, Philly guy, Flyers pre and post game, big bobblehead dude. You love the bobbleheads?
I have one of me.
Yeah, that's
when
fair.
I was like 19, but I do not collect them, no.
You got one when you were 19?
Yeah, I think so. 19 or 20 in Nashville. It was the mustard yellow jerseys and, good time.
That's quick to the career, though. They're like, hey, we got to get Scotty a ball. Although, you're second year in the league. You have 41 points. Like, that's pretty good. You're doing all right. Just that's quick.
Not too shabby.
That's not too shabby, but that's a quick turnaround for a bobblehead. I got to say, like, normally my understanding of a bobblehead is for, like, an established guy that the weirdos get down to the stadium for early and, like, man, I cannot wait to have this thing on a weird shelf in my garage. Or even weirder, I can't wait to try to sell this online and this is how I make my living. That's always a strange one to me.
Yeah, I know. You can find anything on eBay and, the seekers, we call them, too. When you go to a city, they have their binders full of hockey cards and try to get you to sign as many as they can. And next thing you know, they're selling them some third party or whatever.
I got to tell you, too, the seekers, when you leave a ball game early or late, you leave an arena late and you see the fellas that are waiting outside the gates and are just, like, you're spending your entire night there, that's a sad sight. That's a sad sight. I'd rather see you picking through garbage than do that. I'm like, that's a way more respectable way to get a living, is to be picking through the trash than to be waiting and trying to seek the autograph signing as a grown adult. Just got to say, that's my feeling on it. Okay, so what's you got the inside scoop. Can you say what Tort said? I know he wouldn't leave the bench. That's why he got the suspension. Bad boy. How did you feel about it? What's the word around Philly?
I was calling the game and I was watching, him lose his mind, right? I wasn't really watching the monitor and I kind of peeked to the monitor and he's like, I'm not blank leaving. And I'm like, okay, must have did something. And then I saw Wes McCauley, kind of toss him. And obviously he was upset, number one, with the two penalties that were called. And they scored two goals on those power plays. And then just 1 week goal by Sam Harrison. And before you could blink, it was 4-0. So I think he was just losing it, trying to wake his group up. But, wanted to hit the showers early, I guess. And paid the piper with the $50,000 in two games. And And yeah, that's that. It's kind of not in the past yet because he'll miss tonight's game against the Leafs. But you know, he's still doing his thing. He's still playing the mind games and all that, and it's been effective here.
So obviously, like, you got fined in your career? I'm sure, right? You were a villain.
Yeah, I got suspended and fined a couple times.
Yeah, exactly. And listen, not your situation, but have you ever, something like that? 50K, it's a lot of money for a coach. Sometimes the owners, though, they're like, all right. You ever hear about anybody like back channeling that pay where you're like, hey, don't worry about it. We'll take care of this somehow on the low.
Yeah. Dan Hilferty, the CEO of Comcast and the Flyers, he said, whatever the fine is, we're going to pay it. He's our leader. He's sticking up for the guys. So it's not going to come out of his pocket. Right. And, which is a cool move because they've been trying to change the culture here and, the way things are run, kind of like it was when Ed Snyder was alive.
Yeah.
And it's been phenomenal, the change that I've seen in the past, you know, 2 years compared to the previous 4 or 5, 6 years. So kind of hats off to the people having people's back, right? You want
sure.
Being a leader like Torts is, kind of changing the whole psyche of the team, the dressing room, you know, the organization. And they're thanking him for that.
I wouldn't last 2 days if there was that kind of safety net for me. I would be immediately done. I would be canceled.
Well, I'm sure they draw the line somewhere.
Yeah, I know. And I would find it immediately. Like, you guys are going to take care of this fine and you're going to back me, right? They'd be like, yeah, no, never mind any of that we said. Do you get a little bit more sentimental watching a guy like Torso? You talk about them trying to change the culture, but do you feel like when you're watching them, damn, coaches like him are going to start to go the way of the dodo, right? And so there's going to be fewer and fewer characters behind the bench, especially that have the reputation and the ability to, be that way, that angry all the time with their players, the media, whatever. Yeah, do you see that lasting? I'm sure there will be the odd one, but I don't know. I kind of watch him now and go, I'm going to miss this a little bit.
Yeah, well, I think he's changed his ways a ton,
for sure.
Actually, when he, when he was in New York and Tampa and, you know, I think his outbursts are kind of maybe few and far between now than what they were, you know, say 5, 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. Different players nowadays than it was, 10 years ago as well. I think everyone's a little bit more sensitive now, and you can't scream and yell because, people will just kind of hide in their shell, right? So you got to reach these players in different ways. And, one of Torts' ways to kind of send a message to a player is scratching them from the lineup. Mm-hmm. And you can't take their money away because they're already signed. You can put guys in the minors if it goes that far. But, if me personally, I wanted to play every single game if I was banged up, if I was sick or whatever. And I've been scratched by Torts in Columbus, and it hurts your ego. Yeah? It hurts your pride. And you respond, you come back, and you score, 5 goals in the next 5 games, and he looks like a mad genius behind the bench doing that, right? So there's a few tricks that coaches have left to kind of tinker with players and kind of help them out or straighten them out, and Torts has kind of always had that one in his back pocket.
Mm-hmm. So the ref part of this, they don't speak on it, and what ends up happening here because this is all sports. This isn't just like a hockey problem. There's like this in basketball, they have the 2-minute report where the ref will basically take some culpability if they miss a call, but that's it. There doesn't seem to be any suspension or anything like that happens. NFL, same thing, where they'll blow huge calls. Like the most infamous one this year was the Cowboys-Lions game, and they went, no more night games for this ref, but then he ended up in a night game right after. So you go, okay, not really sure what the accountability is. Did you feel as a player that the refs were at least accountable to you? Because it does seem like that league, you can get away with more in terms of speaking to the officials, right? You can say more to the official on the ice than in any of the other leagues. Like basketball, you throw the ball down hard and they're like, tech. Hockey, you can give it to somebody within reason. But what was your relationship like with refs? Because you were a lippy guy, I would imagine that you've said some things. Did you feel they were accountable to you? Like you could pull a guy aside and have a reasonable chat, or at the end of it, they were like, no, we're above the law.
Yeah, I was heated, not every game, but most games.
Yeah.
Whether it was a bad penalty on us or myself or, a missed call by them and usually some choice words were involved, but, they give it right back to you. And then you kind of, you know, give him a tap on the shin pads and move on, right? And, and then there's sometimes where it's really bad where you cross the line. And, you know, I didn't get too many, like, technicals or extra 2 minutes. Probably could have got a lot more if to be real with you. But it's one of those things where you kind of give and take. And, you know, some refs do think that they're, you know, there's 18,000 people watching them, where that's not the case. But that's for another story. But yeah, it's usually kind of, you know, tit for tat, right? You give it, you got to take it, and vice versa. But no one's perfect, right? They can't make every single call or, you know, see every single slash or hook on the hands. You know, I think they do a pretty good job for the most part.
I will say I don't mind it. I actually love bitching about refs. I think it's fun. I think it's just a thing that all fans kind of get to do together for the most part. It can go too far, then you argue about complaining about the refs too much and blah, 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 blah. But ultimately, it's fine. Like, it's why I don't want robot umpires in baseball. I think it would take away a core fun part of being a fan, which is being able to cry about the officials. But I also do hate it a little that the accountability is never as transparent. Like, if it's a major blown call, I'd let the ref speak on it, you know? Or if there is something that results in a 2-game suspension, let the ref talk about it with the media a little bit. I don't know why they have to be protected and precious. And that's what drives me crazy, is when they try to really act like sympathetic figures. And again, this is an NBA one, but the NBA ran an ad like 5-6 years ago where they were showing blown calls to fans in the streets. And then the fans would be like, that's awful, that guy's an idiot. And then the ref, like, popped out of the bushes and was like, would you say that to my face? I was like, yeah, it would be amazing to, actually. This is the greatest moment of my life. And they were like, we're real people, too. I was like, nah, not really, though. Like, kind of, but not really. Like, yeah, when you're at the grocery store, but not when you're on the ice and doing the job. Did you have a ref you hated the most?
Yeah.
Say.
St. Pierre.
Okay. Why?
He was just kind of cocky. He was French. He was just thought he was, like, way too cool for school. And you know, you'd look at the guy wrong, and he'd be looking for you to give you a call, right? And it was kind of a 50-50 call, like clean hit or whatever. It was boring, and he got under my skin, but. It's the same thing about refereeing, but, you know, when the playoffs start, you know, there's probably 5 or 8 calls a game that were called like that, or penalties that were called in game 5 of the season, but not called in game 5 or 6 of the first round, right? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of, you know, weird how it all works, but everyone says there's nothing better than playoff hockey. Let them play, let them figure it out instead of some, you know, ticky-tack slash that, you know, broke a composite stick where it's already probably fractured anyway, right? So...
Yeah. So speaking of things you hated, I think you deeply hated the Leafs. And I think it's the same reason deep down that it is with Colby Armstrong, who's a friend, is that you like, there's something like the Saskatchewan waters where it's just, you're born and bred to hate Toronto in general. You're just like, I hate it there. I hate the people there. I hate the city there. I hate the hockey team. That's just ingrained in you from a young age. I don't know if it's born or just taught, whatever it is, but either way, it's a Sasky thing. But yeah, did you hate them as much as it seemed like when you played them? Like, I know you had this stuff with Phaneuf, but it did seem like you got up for Leaf games and you always wanted to stick it to the Leafs in particular.
It's, you know, the mecca of hockey, right? That's kind of the heartbeat of Hockey Town, whatever you want to call it. And, you know, you always tried to be up for those games, right? Because I knew it would be, my buddies and my friends and family would be watching on, on TV across Canada. So it was always, sorry, someone's calling me. It was always cool to play on Hockey Night in Canada as a kid. You grew up watching it, and now you're playing it. So it was always, you had that little extra jump in your step. And yeah. It was always nice to beat them or play hard or score a goal. I like watching them play. They're a fun team to watch when they're winning, and when they're losing, everyone wants to run in the streets and get hit by a car.
Dude, yes. They haven't won a Stanley Cup since 1967. I don't know if you heard that before. People here are pissed, and the team is the biggest issue now, and I think the reason why it's even more up and down than it ever has been before is everybody got a little too cocky when they got the 3 young guys. Everybody here was, holy crap, you got these 3 dudes, and then they signed Tavares, and there was a real sense of, well, there's no way they're not going to break this. There's no way they're finally going to get this done. They built the team the right way, and then, yeah, the rest is history. But what you're saying, like, you like watching them when they're winning. Yeah, do you think it's any different this year when you watch them? Do you think, hey, you know, the stars are starting to come to their own a little bit more, the core around them is a little bit better, or do you feel like they're going to get to the playoffs and it's going to be more of the same?
Well, you guys, media will just say it'll be the same.
Yeah.
I think they're, I don't know, in a position better this year where there's kind of a little bit less pressure. You know, they're not top of the division, you know, this or that. So you kind of slide in, you know, looking at the standings, it's pretty clear they will be in, but it's you know, not to be the home ice. It's nice to play in the road too. And I know Luke Shen, when he was there, it was like, man, like this city is like nuts. So, you know, just how passionate your fans are, but how much pressure they put on the players. Right. So it's a little bit of a catch 22 in that respect, but yeah, it's no matter who they end up playing, if it's Tampa or Boston, it's going to be a fun series.
First of all, though, let me just say this. Let me clarify this. You and I are the same now, all right? We're media. You're in media. You're a pre-post-game host, all right? We're the same. You're media. You're with us. You're like, oh, the media, you guys are burying. You're with us. We're standing together. We're arm in arm. We're colleagues now.
Oh, I'd never throw anyone under the bus or anything like that.
Oh, never. Never do it. Never, ever, ever. I think, yeah, we do it absolutely sometimes. It always goes overboard. I think there is a difference in terms of, being a player and trying to avoid that because you know where you've been with it. But, yeah, it is kind of fun to be able to hold guys to account. Okay, I got a couple more things for you. One is, I was thinking about this the other day, and, you know, when I was getting ready for this interview, I saw that you had 54 game-winning goals in your career, which is, like, a really good number. It's actually really impressive. Again, you had a 17-year career, long career, but a lot of game-winning goals. I was watching 3-on-3 the other night, and Matthew scored one, and they flashed that he's got the most before he's 27 since Gretzky. And I thought, you know, that's kind of a meaningful stat, game-winning goals. Whenever I was growing up, it was always game-winning goals. That was such a marker of how clutch you were, how you played in the big moments, whether you were on the ice for big moments too, right? And now they've added 3-on-3, and I don't think we've ever really, it hasn't been a big part of the discourse anyways, but we're starting to see guys accumulate real numbers in their careers as to, like, how many they have of these, but a lot end up coming on 3-on-3. Like, for Matthews, he's got 11 on 3-on-3 overtimes, and you played in both realities, right? Because I think it came into effect 2015 or 2016 when they went to 3-on-3, but yeah, how do you feel about, like, the game-winning goal stat now that we have so many guys that get so many in 3-on-3, which is basically like a skills competition?
Goal is a goal. Okay. It's pretty hard to score a goal. It's pretty hard to score a goal in the National Hockey League. And if you got the speed to be in those positions where you're, you know, a guy like me was not going on 3-on-3, maybe 4-on-3. Yeah. But hey, it's they're out there for a reason, and the best skilled players in the world. So it's pretty cool to see him pot a goal, especially 3-on-3 with a shot. But as for hopefully he doesn't do it tonight, though, against the Fly Guys.
I hope he does. Somebody told me that you're friends with Jason Kelsey. Is that true?
Nope. I'm not.
You're not? Okay. You ever met him?
I'd like to be.
Yeah, everyone seems to like to be. I thought I was going to get a Jason Kelsey story from you. Maybe I got fed wrong information. Okay, last one. This isn't a radioing thing, but it did happen. You did think that Matthews might end up wanting to be out because of the media stuff. I'm guessing that as a former player that, yeah, like you said with the Luke Shen thing where guys talk about it a lot, has that amped up in recent years, or is that something that you think has been, yeah, like has that grown in the social media era? Has that been there the entire time, the exact same way? Like, where do you stand in terms of guys not liking this place because of that pressure, because of that noise, to the point where, yeah, it would cause a guy like you to question whether or not, like, a superstar would want to play here?
Well, yeah, some people thrive off it, you know, to hold them accountable. Like, you know, I started my career in Nashville, and there was one beat writer and, you know, barely a camera there after practices, right? So you didn't really have pressure. And then you come to Philadelphia, and it's like, you know, there's four or five beat writers, and there's cameras, all the big news stations, and it's like, holy crap, this is a lot different than what we came from, and it did hold you accountable, and I like that more than, you know, not having someone push you or someone write a story about you that's, you know, you haven't scored in five or eight games where, I didn't mind it, but that's just me. So pretty. Some people can handle it, some people don't. Some people thrive on it, some people can't handle the pressure. So to each his own, and it's you go where the money is too. If they're giving $15 million, pretty hard to say no to that.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. Hey Scott, thanks for your time today, buddy, and have a great call tonight.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Cheers, man. Scott Arnold, former NHL forward, 17 years in the league, Flyers pre- and post-game host. I still don't like the game-winning goal thing. Yeah, I know what he's saying. Goal's a goal, kind of. Game-winning goal is, to me, a cherished stat. Always was. How many game-winning goals? Damn. Now, you're on the ice, sure. That's part of it. You're getting to be out there for 3-on-3. I do think it changes. I do think it changes. And some people be like, yeah, you know, the NBA used to not have a three-point line. Sure. Games evolve. Rules change. But that's like a fundamental one that does alter a really, really significant stat. To me, anyways. The way I've been feeling about it lately. But he's got 54 of them. So I think his opinion probably speaks a little bit more than mine. All right, quick break. Let's hit what we missed. All right, Leafs talk tonight because the Leafs finally play a hockey game. They got a weird close to the season where there's going to be a ton of games in April. It's like they play, I'll say 10 times in 17 days, 9 times in 17 days. It's a lot. It's a heavy schedule to close the season. They've got these weird gaps. But yeah, they're back at it with the Flyers tonight. Again, there's going to be no Mitch Marner. I'm off tomorrow, though, this show. I'll do Leafs Talk tonight, so subscribe and review. Do that to this podcast as well. But yeah, going to do Leafs Talk tonight, break down this game, and I won't be here tomorrow. Taking a day off, long week, doing my 9-to-5s. That's the thing. I'll do 9-to-5s, but then I want to take off the Friday. I told you, I'm a champion of the person that works the 9-to-5, the people who still go into work, the non-Gen Zs who want to spend 4 of them from home, not actually working or grinding like Armin, who came up with DeRozan night for my show today. For those of you that are the hardworking 9-to-5ers, I love you to death, but I will always fight for you to get the 4-day week. I will always fight for you to get the 4-day week. We have the studies, all right? And I believe in the studies that we're more productive and it's better for all of us if that's what we're doing. We got to stop pushing the work from homes and keep pushing the 4-day weeks. And the 3-day weekends. My God, would that be sweet. We can, together, make a better world. There's always, you know, climate change. We gotta get the cars off the road. Boom, they tie in together, right? That goes together. We're always trying to make it better for climate change. We're not trying to make it better for the working person, and that's what I'm trying to do. That's what I'm trying to say. 4-day weeks. 4-day weeks for us all, and I'm going to lead by example by not being here tomorrow. So what is, by the way, what is the big DeRozan night? Like, what is your, this is your whole, this was your, all your work yesterday. This is everything you did. You're scrambling today to try to throw old stories at me that have been pitches that I, like, don't want. So hit me with DeRozan night, because here's, hold on. Here's your big... This is your big moment, Armin. This is your big moment. DeRozan night. Make it count, baby. Like, let's go. DeRozan night. What do we got?
Well, DeMar passed Dwayne Wade for 33rd all-time on the NBA scoring list.
Wow,
which
33rd.
Which is not an easy feat, okay?
No, I know, but
we look at Dwayne Wade like he's one of the best all-time. DeRozan just passed him.
We were all waiting for when would someone pass the 33rd player on the NBA's all-time scoring list. 33rd, the Larry Bird number.
He also hit a game tying, fade away, baseline.
Saw the shot.
Yeah. Game tying shot. And then won the game for them in OT also. Uh-huh. So, anyways, I just wanted to give DeMar some love. He's underrated. That's it. That's all I wanted to do. Yeah.
Is that nothing?
Passing Dwayne Wade on the all time scoring list is like nothing.
So, you feel as though, well, what's the take? What's the opinion? Give DeMar love, because I'm pretty sure that this market, out of all of the markets on planet Earth, has given DeMar DeRozan a lot of love. I think that people here have a lot of positive feelings for DeMar DeRozan here. I think that if you went to a bar in Toronto late enough at night and you just started yelling bad things about DeMar DeRozan, someone would get at you. someone would tell you to shut up. You wouldn't get away with it.
I don't think it's as universal as we take it, the love here. Because, yeah, he got so much hate for the clutch time performances when he was here.
He did. And then he left, and people eulogized him. But, yeah, all right, shout out to DeMar DeRozan. That's what you want to do, is you want to shout out the multimillionaire and just say much love to him. Is the take that he's in some way passing Dwayne Wade underrated as a player, or in some way better than Dwayne Wade? Because, like, Dwayne Wade's
just
is
career
pretty
underrated, I feel.
Nah.
No, you don't feel that way?
Not even in the slightest. If anything, his career is overrated. I love DeMar DeRozan. He's one of my favorite.
Overrated?
Yeah, no question. He's one of my favorite players ever. I loved him when he was a Raptor, and I was actually a staunch defender of him. I was one of those people who used to be at games I remember how many people would criticize him in the stands, and I love how we're doing this because he was 33rd on the all-time scoring list. Yeah, it's an era of more scoring. He's had a long career. He's been a long scorer. He's had a lot of opportunity basically from age, 19? Dwayne Wade retired early because his body didn't hold up the same way as DeMar's. He fell apart because he was a far more physical player. DeMar DeRozan is a perimeter player, not in the sense that he hits threes, but someone who has worked a lot of long twos. Also gets the free throw line, but didn't take the hard contact of a D. Wade. Wade, when he was in his prime of scoring, when he was flash, it's the same thing with Derrick Rose, where the body just can only take so many hits, so many bumps, and that's the way that it went. It actually makes Russell Westbrook even more of a fascinating athlete because he's the only point guard that really played that style in the recent, in this game, who was able to survive it and who continues to just be a Mack truck, who can just get to the basket time and time again still, and plays with that kind of physicality, but never really broke down. Like the injury that Russell Westbrook sustained was a cheap shot from Pat Bev. It wasn't like his body fell apart. Good for DeMar. He's a good player. He's an all-time good. He's obviously never going to be great. He's had zero playoff success. He's bounced around a bunch of teams after he left the Raptors. And this is kind of who he is. You can put him on a team, and they'll end up being good in the regular season. Well, usually not great.
Hasn't been on a great team.
Well, I would argue that those Raptors teams, that it's kind of tough to say he wasn't on a great team, and then he got swapped out with Kawhi Leonard, and that team went on to win a championship.
No, I mean, after the Raptors, I meant. After the Raptors, what great team has he been on? Who's been his best player that he's played with? Zach LaVine?
He got multiple chances to be in the postseason with the Raptors, and he was benched against LeBron. He didn't just perform poorly. He performed historically poorly. Every single DeMar DeRozan playoff run was marred by, why is this looking so hard? Why is George Hill shutting you down? Why do you need to have a Norm Powell game when he's a rookie or a second-year player to get you through it? Why are you getting cooked by the Washington Wizards? Why are you having to struggle every single season to get out of the first round? And it was because DeRozan's game didn't translate well to the playoffs, and he kept falling apart. Like, that is a part of this. He didn't get one chance. He didn't get one run. It wasn't simply LeBron James was a dominant player. DeMar sucked in the playoffs, and he never really had signature moments. He had one against the Pacers when they kind of wrote him off, and he came back, and he had, I think it was a good game 3 or 4. But for the most part, wasn't that good. Was it like a really disappointing playoff figure? In some ways, what ended up being kind of the best thing for DeMar DeRozan was that he became more of a sympathetic figure in the trade for Kawhi Leonard. Like, he leaves for Kawhi, and everyone goes, hey, man, you know, he was pretty tough here, and it sucks that we liked him so much deep down. He was so much our guy. He was someone who re-signed in Toronto, someone who loved Toronto, who openly was like, I loved being in the city. I became a man in the city. The best thing that ever happened for me, that I got to spread my wings and move to a different country. He appreciated it. He got it. He's insightful. He had a great relationship with Kyle Lowry. He was a fun player to watch. Cool player to watch. Cool player to have on your team. But ultimately, no. Like, this is a sport of what do your best players do for you? DeMar DeRozan had ample opportunities to be the best player on multiple teams. And when the chips were down, he came up short every single time. Every single time he came up short. And so, yeah, I don't think that he's underrated at all. I think that he gets the proper amount of love, which is a lot. I think that anybody with a brain appreciates what he does. But that because he ended up being the sacrificial lamb for a championship, people actually look at him more favorably than they would have in under any other circumstance. Had the Raptors not gotten a championship, that same kind of love wouldn't be there the same way. Had the Raptors not gotten a championship, actually, I think that people probably would have been like, man, enough, DeMar. Like, enough about saying that the Raptors did you dirty. It's part of the business. It sucks. But how many chances did you want with that team? How many chances did you want to go to the playoffs and show the same thing? LeBron out of the East, like, that was always a weak mentality for me too, which was, oh, well, they didn't get a chance with lone LeBron. It's like, oh, okay, man, I guess.
No, that sucked. They hated that comment he made.
It's just like, all right.
But good enough to get traded for a superstar. So.
Yeah, good enough to get, exactly. And, well, that, again, mitigating circumstances, we look at that one a little weird too, because that is obviously Masai's best trade of all time, but part of it was that the Lakers basically tried to collude to get Kawhi. He wanted to go to Los Angeles, and the Spurs were bitter about it, and they said, screw that, we're not sending you to L.A. And they turned down what ultimately would have been a more valuable trade package. They held the Lakers over the fire and said, we want all three of your young guys, which at the time were, I believe, Brandon Ingram, Lonzo Ball, and it wasn't Josh Hart. It was Julius Randle. I think they wanted all three in that trade package, and the Lakers were like, obviously we're not doing that because we feel as though we're going to sign Kawhi the next offseason anyway. We feel like we're going to get him. We'll give you, I think they were even offering two.
Maybe Kuzma was in there, yeah.
Maybe, but I think that they said, we'll give you two of them. And the Spurs were like, nah, we're sending him to Basketball Siberia. We're sending him up north to Toronto. And people here were like, wow, is he even going to play in Toronto? Like, he didn't want to play for the Spurs. He bought in. He did the thing, and he ripped it up. But a big part of Kawhi landing here was also the Spurs were willing to accept Pirtle the first and DeRozan because they did not want Kawhi to go to the Lakers and win a championship.
Well,
which,
they won a championship the next season.
They did. It was great. It was awesome. It was an awesome, awesome, awesome run. But yeah, I don't think that DeRozan necessarily was like, I don't think that the Spurs had the wrong idea. They wanted to remain competitive. They thought that he could do that, but I don't know. A guy that really always struggled defensively, like, say what you want about, like, I know we're just doing the D Wade thing, but Dwayne Wade was one of the best defensive players in the NBA for a really long time. He's won championships. DeMar DeRozan was always a defensive liability.
Yeah, pure scorer.
Anyway, I don't even like talking about this because I like DeRozan so much. And here's the thing, too, is my favorite players to watch in general in basketball is like good decision makers offensively who have different offensive packages. I always loved another guy who was a perennial playoff choker who never got anything done in the playoffs. Jamal Crawford is one of my favorite players of all time. The handle, the shooting ability, the pull-ups, the herky-jerky style, getting the basket, I love him. Same thing with DeMar. The footwork of DeMar DeRozan offensively is elite, elite, elite. One of my favorite things to watch in all of basketball. DeMar hitting late-game shots, clutch shots. It's weird. I think he's a really clutch regular season player because he has a lot of these, but he was never a clutch postseason guy. Absolutely not. When it came to the postseason, it didn't work out. Also, a real champion of mental health, like not someone who I think is, like, we see a lot of it. We're like, oh, it's brave, it's brave, it's brave. I think for DeRozan, it actually was. I think that his stuff has been sincere and real and honest and important, and that he's been an important figure in that space, especially for athletes. Him and Kevin Love specifically come to mind for me when I think about guys in that area, and both have done a lot. So, yeah, good career, but, I don't really – that's kind of it. It's like your clutch. Last night's a perfect example of that. You're clutch in the regular season, and then you're not clutch in the playoffs. And then a team with you as the guy who gets the last shot in a game isn't going anywhere. And that's where the Chicago Bulls are. Is they're in perfect DeRozan purgatory, which is you're good and you're not doing anything. You're not making any noise in the playoffs.
I hope he gets a chance. I know I'll move on, but hope he gets a chance towards the end of his career on a different team.
I hope he gets a chance. I hope so too. I hope that he finally gets a chance because that's the one thing that he never was afforded.
No, like to be on a good team, to be the third or fourth best player on the team is what I mean.
Again, that team was supposed to be good. They moved in a lot of chips. They went out and got Vucevic. No.
Oh, the Bulls. Yeah,
he's been a two-time All-Star with that team, and they did. Again, I don't like Zach LaVine. I think that Zach LaVine is a losing basketball player, and I don't love Vucevic either. But that team went out and collected multiple good players, and they said, let's win. They've had things happen to them, but they should have been more competitive. They should have felt like, okay, at least are you going to be at the top? It's like, no. You couldn't even have a season where it's like what the Orlando Magic have right now. So, no, I don't really. I think he's been afforded a lot of opportunities, man. Like, when we're saying, oh, well, he could be on a good team, like, this is someone who takes, like, what, 17 to 20 shots a game, basically throughout his entire career? It's a lot. You own that. I don't like the idea of, like, oh, what's he supposed to be, the fourth guy on a team? Like, nah, what are we talking about here? Anyways, DeRozan's had a ton of opportunity. Multiple-time All-Star, good player, really, really good player. But no, I don't think that him passing Wade as 33rd is changing any type of outlook on his career. What else?
To back up what Scott Hartnell said about his least favorite ref in the game, Justin St. Pierre, there was a poll that The Athletic conducted in 2024 in January. Mm-hmm. And Justin St. Pierre is no surprise. 29% of all NHL players who were in the poll voted Justin St. Pierre as the worst ref in the game. And to back that up, even the NHL knows it, because he has refed almost 1,200 regular season games. He's only refed 8 playoff games. Mm. So it goes to show over the course of his career, the NHL hasn't trusted him either.
He's been someone that has been publicly criticized by many players. It's no surprise that his name ended up getting referenced, because this is not the first time a media member has gone and said him. So that's all you need to know. what was the word he used? He's a cocky guy.
Yeah.
I think
too cool.
Well, I was going to say, I think that if you search him, I think if you search St. Pierre, you'll find him having quotes defending himself against media attacks in the past. Because I'm pretty sure I've seen them before. Anyways, what's next?
Okay, quick point on your Sopranos thing. I just want to say, I started watching Sopranos because you were making so many references to it. So I was actually opposite of the guy who texted it to you. I was like, I am not listening to another Sopranos reference without not knowing what's going on.
How deep in are you?
I'm literally, it's first season. I'm in like 7th episode maybe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that why you're not working?
Yeah, man. Yeah. Man, grind away.
Yeah, I was like, yeah.
What okay. age did you watch it at, though? I gotta Were you tell my you. Age when you watched it or younger?
I started watching it live in 2002. Yes. Yeah, 2002. 2002, we got some kind of... We had a television package that... It's when... Everybody had those horrific TVs that lasted 5 seconds, those home theater flat screens with the sound built in at the bottom that were heavy and bulky, and they had the like lights in the back. I forget what these kind of televisions are called. I'm not a tech guy. I don't know too much about them, but it was like
plasmas?
No. Not plasma TVs. They were these big flat screen TVs that like happened in the early 2000s. And for like a hot second, they were, wow, they were a real status piece. And then all of a sudden they were going for like 45 cents. And our family got one when they were like 45 cents, but we went, oh my God, because we were a family that had the same crappy TV for forever. We had like a big bubble TV forever that we called the big screen that was probably like, I don't know, 36 inch television. Like that was the big screen in our house. It was like, yo, you want to watch it on the big screen? Like, oh yeah. Cause the other screen was the kitchen TV.
So, I love how kitchen TVs were a thing before.
Dude, kitchen TVs were the bomb. The amount of NBA basketball that I had watched hunkered down in my kitchen, watching on the tiniest, blurriest screen.
Antennas at the top?
Infinite. No, not that. I never had an antenna TV. But, yeah. Oh, actually, well, it would have had antennas, I guess, but they were collapsible. It's not like what you think. It would have been like the silver collapsible antennas. But there were these home system TVs that everybody got. And they would like have wheels even at the bottom because like you had to wheel it around. They were so heavy, they were so bulky. And we got some free subscription to HBO through some cable package. And I was blown. It was became my favorite thing. Like it was like, oh my God, cannot wait. Late night HBO. We're moving on up. We went from late night TV for me used to be like Blind Date. A limit date, horrible television shows.
Is that
like
Love
that.
Is Blind the original?
Those are the OG reality TV series. Yes, that's what I'm saying. That was our options, late night television. Like it was a nightmare out there. To all of a sudden I had HBO. And I remember watching, it was Sopranos season 3. So Sopranos season 3, I was watching along with it and being like, this is the greatest thing. And then I got the DVDs. And so, I was watching it. I watched it the first time. I watched it fully through while it was happening. Like, I watched Sopranos as a kid live.
Like, waiting a week between episodes.
Yeah, and then I probably ended up watching it, like, I don't know, 5 or 6. I think it's the greatest television show of all time. I've done rankings before, and I'll try to piece together, like, what... It's hard for me because I really like comedies and dramas, and... I think I'm a TV snob now. Mm-hmm. Like, I do. I think I'm very much a TV snob. But every time I do the list, I'm like, I used to be a hipster. I used to say The Wire was the best, but The Wire is not the best. The Wire is very, very, very good. It's in my list. It's very much at the top for me, but Sopranos is the perfect, is just about the perfect show. The ending has grown on me as I've gotten older. I hated it when it first happened. When it happened live, I was like, oh my God. Thank God I didn't have Twitter then, because I would have had a meltdown on Twitter. I was like apoplectic with
the ending. Don't give the details, please. I think you're about to. So Chuck, do you go back and still check in and like casually like watch it?
No, I've rewatched the show many times over the course of my life, but it's never like a drop in and watch an episode of a show.
Okay.
Yeah. That doesn't happen.
Like front to back or nothing.
Yeah, front to back or nothing at all. Front to back or nothing at all. And I've say that I've probably front to backed The Sopranos 6 times.
Holy.
Yeah.
It's like 5-6 seasons at least, no?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Holy, yeah.
Yeah.
I probably watch, yeah, at least. Actually, Sicko, one of the best things you can do when you're like, if I've done this with more than one girlfriend where they've been like, I've never seen that. I'm like, this is what we're watching now. This is what we're doing. We're strapped in, and they're not invested nearly as much as me. And I'm like, get ready. Like, it's their practice. Like, they've got a game tonight. I'm like, you ready to watch Sopranos tonight? Like, you ready? You already strap in, watch as many episodes as we possibly can. Yeah, no, Sopranos is a goat. It's the greatest show of all time. Someone just tweeted at me, it's rear projection TV. That's exactly what it is. Those things
never
sucked. Those things sucked so badly. And I was a mover in university, and when people had those things and you show up in the basement, you're like, ah!
Oh, you were two men with the truck.
Yeah, I was. I was two men with the truck, literally. I've done that job. I was swamping. I was loading trucks. I've done many jobs.
Oh, my God. Those are huge, dude. I'm just looking at the rear projection TVs.
Yeah, like, buddy.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Mitsubishi HD.
Dude, and they lasted like 10 seconds. There was a real hot minute where it was like, this was...
See, that's weird, because usually the opposite with those older technologies, they last forever. So that's...
No. This thing... No. And first of all, yeah, they also died out. Like the bulbs, the rear projection bulbs would burn out. Like they were notoriously crap. But also, yeah, just heavy pieces of garbage. Heavy pieces of garbage. The amount, by the way, when I was a mover, the amount of those that I got offered from customers being like, hey, you can have, like, oh, really? I can have your garbage old TV that's probably broken and bring it to my university? Like, I could have built a castle out of the TVs that I was offered, those rear projection TVs in the, yeah, late 2000s from the earliest. Those things died out immediately. They were garbage.
Was that like, oh, that was like why you were... student.
Yeah, when I was a student, I was more. Yeah. In the summers. Grind.
Solid workout. Not bad.
Yeah. What would you know?
I've had friends who've done it.
I was going to say, DeRozan night. That's what I got.
My dad had me out there mowing the lawn since I was 10. So.
Whoa, mowing the whole lawn?
Mowing the lawn, shoveling the driveway, of course.
Wow, I don't think most kids do that. I don't think
I have heard Gunning and Ennis complain about that, actually, like on the morning show, that the kids aren't out there. They got their dads out there. That's crazy.
Nah, I did every chore.
Same.
I did every single chore. I love, though, that you think that a chore is a job. That is incredible. Anyway, all right. We got to go. Subscribe to the podcast. Leave 5 stars. We'll see you next week.